from KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. There's a cottage industry engaged in offering counsel to the Democratic Party these days. And to those scores of advice books, add one more by Air America talk show host Laura Flanders. It's called Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Flanders' book profiles grassroots efforts around the country and makes the argument that the Democratic Party is too focused on short-term, Washington-oriented thinking and not focused enough on the core causes of true Democrats. Laura Flanders, our guest, next on Forum. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Laura Flanders hosts Radio Nation on Air America Radio, heard locally on Saturday nights on The Quake, KQKE, also available on podcast. She's also written four books on politics, media, and women's issues. Her latest book is called Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Flanders believes that the Democratic Party doesn't pay enough attention to its core values and its core constituency. The Democratic establishment has a problem, she writes. It doesn't seem to like its foot soldiers much. Flanders believes that the future of the party is on the ground and that the party needs to develop, not ditch, its base, as she puts it. She worries that the party's leaders are too careful, too cautious on issues ranging from women's reproductive rights to matters of race and poverty, and that for all the importance of language in politics, she argues that too much is made sometimes of how arguments get framed. For all the talk of framing, she says, it's not the frame around what Democrats say that needs to change. It's what's inside the frame and the mechanism that exists for communicating the change. We're going to spend the next hour, then, talking about what ought to go inside that frame for Democrats, but also about talk radio and other subjects as well. Joining us now, Laura Flanders, author of Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Welcome.
Well, what a beautiful introduction. Thank you, Dave. Great to be here.
Pleasure to have you back in the Bay Area. You were on the air, of course, for many years on KALW as well.
Yes, big shout out to all you KALW listeners.
And you had to contend with driving across the Bay Bridge this morning, so you're fully back in the Bay Area. Let's talk about your principal argument in your book, which is this business of Democrats need to be Democrats, in essence, and also to pay attention to what's happening on the ground, not just what's happening to what you call the suites, S-U-I-T-E-S, as opposed to what's on the streets.
Yeah, I mean, the book had its birth on election night 2004 when I was on the air at Air America Radio and was faced with a very gloomy and sad and really heartbroken audience of Democratic activists and supporters who'd really poured their all into that election. And I sometimes called an optaholic on the air, and I tried my best to cheer them up. I had the midnight to 5 a.m. shift. It was really the night of the politically living dead. I said maybe people had seen one too many of those vote or die posters and hadn't imagined doing both. I said, okay, well, the White House seems to be lost, but it's not all bad. You've got more people voting than ever before. You've got more money raised on the Democratic side than ever before. Match the Republicans dollar for dollar, cent for cent. Raise the minimum wage in two red states, Nevada and Florida, with ballot initiatives. And then I woke up the next morning and I thought, am I dreaming? Maybe this country is awash in red. And it seems to me that one of two things was true. Either the country is awash in red and conservative fundamentalist values, or Democrats, the Democratic Party and the campaigns are not doing politics very well. And that's what I went around the country to find out.
And your argument is in part that there is plenty going on elsewhere and in places you wouldn't normally suspect. You write in your book, for example, about Montana.
Yeah, well, I deeply believe in dropping down once in a while, those of us who fly from coast to coast, dropping down in those flyover states and taking a little time to listen to what's going on. I went to Montana, went to Utah, went to Nevada, Mississippi, Florida, all over, and found, some very interesting stuff. Now, you and I, we often complain in the media about horse race coverage of elections, that media cover elections as if they were horse races, and it's a cliche. But why it's a problem is that it makes it look as if the only players that matter are those horses on the track. And what I found is if we paid some more attention to the people in the stands, we would get a whole lot smarter about why elections turn out the way they do. And Montana was a good case in point.
Well, let's talk about what happened there, because people who follow politics know that Brian Schweitzer, the governor of Montana, has received lots of attention, and most recently the new senator from Montana, John Tester. And that's what we think about. We think about those new sort of cowboy Democrats, in a sense. And what you found was that there was more going on in Montana than that.
Yeah, and John Tester and Brian Schweitzer would be the first to tell you about the more that's been going on. Yeah, we see the tip of the iceberg. We see the guy in the cowboy boots and bolo tie. And you sometimes get the impression from the coverage that all that Democrats would have to do to win the West would be to go to the Western Wear store. Not true. I mean, why Brian Schweitzer was able to come to power was because the Democratic Party in that state, which had been written off by Democrats nationally, had embedded itself very well into local communities and had, in 10 years out of office in the state house and in local government, spent its time building relationships on the ground. You also had grassroots groups, very powerful in that state, Montana Conservation Vote, Montana Women Vote, Native Americans vote like African Americans, 80-90% Democratic, and yet they'd been conspicuously unenfranchised, and you had redistricting in the early 2000 that was able to create new native districts that went a long way to helping increase that Democratic vote. You also had grassroots groups filling a vacuum where party machinery wasn't, reaching out to poor women, for example. 40 women's organizations making up this Women Vote Coalition realized, okay, well, low-income women are very low in turnout come election season. Maybe we can change that. If we put low-income women that we work with, who work with those women year-round on issues of health care and getting your benefits and fighting violence and discrimination in the workplace, if we get those same activists on the blocks working for candidates, heck, if we run some of those low-income women as candidates for office, maybe we can make a difference. And they did. And I believe we talk about trickle-down in politics a lot. There's also trickle-up.
Laura Flanders, our guest. Her new book is called Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. You also write in your book some about the debate that took place leading up to the 2006 election between Howard Dean, the chair of the Democratic Party, and Rahm Emanuel in particular on the House side, who had a very different point of view about how Democrats ought to focus and spend their resources in the 2006 election. And you come down very much on the Howard Dean side, this idea of investing in party building 50 states, not just keying in on whatever the key race of the moment is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think Howard Dean and I probably woke up with the same question in our minds after 04. It's like, what is the state of play around the country? And it wasn't pretty. I mean, I went to Nevada, a very well-resourced state by the Democratic Party in 2004, one of the real battlegrounds where I'm sure many of your listeners volunteered to go out and knock doors. That's a state that as late as 2004 had no computerized voter roll, had no full-time communications director until the very beginning of that year, had barely a functioning website. This is simply not doing politics well. And what Howard Dean woke up to was that that was the case of most state parties around the country. And he, with his 50-state project, has enabled those state parties to hire four workers full-time to work around the season, around the clock, not just when an election is happening. That's making all the difference. I was in Mississippi, in Jackson, and found people who had called the Democratic Party to volunteer 15 years ago and were just getting called back. I found that people in states like Nevada were learning how to maintain a voice and maintain a presence year in, year out. And I'm absolutely with Howard Dean. I think that the 2006 election, the margin in particular in the House, was won for Democrats by people fighting battles in districts. I'm thinking of two in the key states of the key primary states of New Hampshire and Iowa. Districts that the DCCC, the Congressional Campaign Committee, didn't even think were worth a fight. And candidates like Carol Shea Porter, who Rahm Emanuel told not to run because she was a very outspoken critic of Bush policy on Iraq, she won. She sits in Congress today, mostly thanks to six retired peace activist women who were her campaign and pushed her over the edge.
Well, let's talk about that part of the equation, too. In addition to your focus on the importance of paying attention to the grassroots and to this ground-up sort of strategy, you also seem to feel that Democrats are too careful, too cautious, and that the belief is that in order to win in our times, you have to sort of tack to the center. And indeed, there are plenty of examples, whether that's someone like Jim Webb, the new senator in Virginia, or Heath Shuler, the new congressman from North Carolina, that are more centrist Democrats. So tell me about why you think that's really not the way to go, that centrism isn't it, and that Democrats need to re-embrace values that are more to the left.
Well, Jim Webb has an interesting mix of things, because he's clearly breaks with the party on some things like fair trade. He has a certain sort of a populist message on many issues, and he's been opposed to the war. The complaint that I have is that we've had now a slew of Democratic presidential candidates who I call kind of lip-sync liberals. They say what they think they should be heard to say, but they come across as sounding, you know, cautious of speech and cut off at the heart, such that you don't really trust them. And when one of these swift boat kind of campaigns happen, and I think we have to accept that this is a nasty part of our politics today, the public is vulnerable to those kinds of personality attacks on these candidates because they seem shady. You don't really believe them. Plus, on a more serious level, they're not providing leadership. Hillary Clinton, when she was asked recently to comment on the sort of despicable comments of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Peter Pace, about homosexuality, she was asked point blank by ABC News, "Do you believe homosexuality is immoral?" Her answer was, "I'll leave that to others to decide." That is not leadership. And I have to say to the Democratic leaders on that issue, you know, gays and lesbians, people of color, women who every so often need or want an abortion, people who are striving immigrants in this country, you may not like it, but that is your base, and that's who you depend on for winning, and you're never going to be against those people and their rights enough to please your enemies. What you need to do is support those ground troops and learn from them, because they can teach you. ACT UP, the AIDS organization, could have told John Kerry, silence equals death.
But is the problem one of embracing those values that you describe Democrats ought? Or is it also a problem of authenticity? In other words, is part of the problem that John Kerry had that he seemed to be sort of shifting and sliding the old, you know, I voted for it before I voted against it sort of stuff? Because it's still true that the two Democratic presidents that have been elected in this country since the 1960s are small governors from small southern states, Jimmy Carter, of course, and Bill Clinton, and that they had a kind of authenticity, albeit a more conservative point of view.
Well, but let's remember, 1992, when Bill Clinton was elected, his program, his platform wasn't what he ended up governing on. His platform, remember the whole program? Well, we had healthcare overhaul. We also had a commitment to reinvest in our cities. We had an urban core reconstruction program, a jobs program. Clinton promised he was going to talk about discrimination in the military. He went into office and was elected on a far more progressive platform. And let's remember, he was helped by a three-way race where Ross Perot skimmed off some of the conservative vote. But he was running on a platform quite different from the kind of policies he governed on that we remember today. So that's one thing worth remembering. And the other, I think, is we've now seen that the United States people, have a majority agreement. Majority of them agree with what was once a marginal position within Democratic left ranks. On Iraq, for example, on free trade, fair trade, you've seen issues pushed from the so-called margins to the center without any national leadership. And again, I think those issues made the difference in 06. And I think it's an interesting example of the difference between the left and the right. On the right, you have a Republican Party that curries favor with the people at its margins, whether those people are utterly out of touch with the mainstream or not. I'm thinking of the Christian right, the libertarian, no taxes right. They will try to make promises to them. They don't always give them everything they want, but they invite them out to dinner, kiss the ring, flirt and seduce. On the Democratic side, it's the opposite. We're kind of treated like lepers when it's when it is acknowledged that we even exist. I think that's changing just a little bit.
But couldn't you also make the argument that that's part of the problem with American politics, that there's too much partisanship, that there's too much of a drift to the polar edges? And just as the Republican Party is sometimes criticized for going too far to the right in its base, in a way, it sounds like you're saying, well, that's what the Democrats should do, only on the left.
Well, not exactly. I mean, I think that the issues, as I said, of the war and of fair trade are not really, at this point, even left-right issues. I mean, the biggest advocates of fair trade are the people that voted for John Tester, who are small farmers in the ranch lands of Montana, not exactly leftists, but their small family farms have been ruined by trade policies that privilege the biggest corporations at the expense of the smallest ones around the world. I think we go back to your question about authenticity, because throughout Blue Grit, the book, I'm trying to tell two stories in parallel. One are the issues, which I do care strongly about, and I don't think that the progressive agenda is out there. What is it? It's we're against torture, we're for diplomacy, we're for nuclear nonproliferation, we like healthcare that's about people, not profits, and we believe in living wages. I mean, none of that's too radical stuff. Oh, and can we have the 14th Amendment, equal protection for everybody? But parallel to the philosophy questions, there's the pragmatics questions. And I think the pragmatics, interestingly, is linked to the authenticity question, because candidates who ring true are candidates whose face you've seen, who you haven't just been brought a computerized message from or a television ad. You've had some relationship, or somebody you know has had some relationship. It requires some engagement with those grassroots troops. And that's, I think, where the Republicans under Karl Rove have been so smart. They created and hooked into social networks on the right and got volunteers to do the work that people on the left were paying for when they sent volunteers, I mean, when they sent activists from groups like America's Coming Together and others to these states to do that work for those months. They were sending strangers onto the streets of Reno and Las Vegas, where the right had people who lived there and went to church every week.
Laura Flanders, our guest. Her book is called Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. I want to ask you also about polarity in a different way, and that's as it relates to the medium that we're participating in this morning, talk radio. A lot has been written, of course, about media on the right and the Rush Limbaugh sort of thing, but you make an interesting comment about it on the other side in your book, about your own network, Air America Radio, and you write, "Much as I love my listeners on Air America Radio, for example, it worries me how little they like to hear from anyone with an opposing view. It's a knee-jerk reaction. Whenever I entertain a call from a conservative, the phones light up and my email box fills with listeners furious that I've fallen prey to a right-wing plot."
Yeah. I think it's very concerning, and I don't know whether you feel it the same way here. But one person said to me in that chapter, Sandy Close, that the genius behind New America Media, a consortium of ethnic media based here in the Bay Area, she said, you know, we're doing very well in the new media, creating niche markets for individual eye voices, whether it's bloggers or websites or streams on satellite radio or TV. But we're losing the communal us, the community voice of us. We no longer have quote-unquote mainstream media. We don't have a single news show that everybody at work watched. So how do we re-knit that community conversation? I think it's a challenge that we all face in the media, and I think it's the challenge of the future, because it scares me, this sense that we only want to hear from people who agree with us. Otherwise, the other side's the enemy. We should be better than that.
But how do you reconcile the need, which I completely agree with, to not just be sort of talking in an echo chamber with people who only agree with you, and your belief that we need to be the Democratic Party, not we, but the Democratic Party needs to be more left of center? It seems to me that those two things are contrary to one another.
Well, I think we're polarizing even in the question. I mean, I think most of the issues I'm raising are not really right-left issues, whether we're talking new alternative sentencing for drug addicts, a huge problem of meth addiction in so-called red states. Utah, for example, I sat in the same thing in Nevada. Utah, I sat in a harm reduction network, a great group that's based in Salt Lake City, that's calling for new approaches to addiction. And I sat in a group of Mormon fathers who were weeping about how their kids had died from overdoses because, being addicts, those around them were terrified to call the cops. They wanted reform, special courts, an approach that would help their kids get off the drugs rather than end them up in jail. That's not a right-left issue, and it's exactly the kind of issue that I think a Democrat could ride on if they were listening to their base.
And are those also the sort of stories that we need to tell more? As someone who lived in the Midwest for many years, I sometimes grow weary of the fact that in the Bay Area, people tend to think the world ends if you go east of the Berkeley Hills. Is that part of it, too, that we tend to talk to literally our own zip code too much?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there's always something to be said for preaching to the choir. Otherwise, the choir won't come back. So there is something to be said for that. But I think we make assumptions about who the other is. And there are assumptions that are encouraged by the kind of polarizing media that you're talking about. They're even encouraged by that electoral college map we see every night on election night. I talk about it in the book. I don't believe the country is blue versus red. When you look close up at the county maps, it's purple. People win who've got a very narrow margin. We talk a lot about the way the right is structured and how they build power. I think it's time to talk about the very real relationships that have moved progressive policy forward. And just going back to those bereaved Mormon dads again, they were listening to experts from needle exchange programs from here in the Bay Area or New York. So you've got a guy who's a long-term conservative, probably Republican-voting Mormon, listening to the expertise and appreciating the expertise of a guy who grows out of the AIDS movement of the 1980s in New York. This is extraordinary stuff and interesting and exciting to me because it gives hope.
And do we also then in the media need to do a better job of making those connections so that we're not just talking to ourselves?
I think so, and it does take some guts on the part of a politician to say, you know what, this is a problem, even though there isn't at this moment a majority around this issue, I'm going to stake out some turf here. If we'd waited for civil rights to be an acceptable position, we would still have a law against biracial marriages. We've got sometimes to follow our conscience as people in politics and push the public in a direction we think they ought to go. And if there's a fight there, then let the chips fall where they may. I had an interesting conversation with a Christian right broadcaster when the book first came out last week, and he said, it sounds like you want your side to articulate their position in the same way we'd like our side to be clear about what they believe. And he said, if I believe my guy, if he looked into the camera and said, we will stop abortion, he'd win. And I said, well, I believe if somebody looked into the camera and said, we will guarantee equal protection under the law, she'd win. And we just kind of laughed and said, well, no matter who would win, at least we would have a fair and enlivening discussion instead of this kind of stuff that I think turns people off because they know it's all about money and caution and kind of careful plotting and spin. And who wants to be part of that? It just ends up feeling like you're part of somebody else's board game. And this is supposed to be people politics. This is about what is happening in our lives, not just in Congress.
Laura Flanders, our guest, her book, Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. We need to take a break in just a moment, and when we return, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. But just a quick thought before we go to break on why it is that Air America Radio has struggled. Why hasn't it found the responsiveness that you see on the other side?
Well, it's sad to say, but I do think that liberals with money want their real liberal media, which is to say not the kind we have that's called that by the right, but they don't really want to pay for it. I mean, you look at the investment that right-wing ideologues made into Rush Limbaugh 10 years before he was any good at all, and yet they poured in millions of dollars. Fox Network, 10 years before it broke a profit. Air America's investors wanted us to go into the black in, I think, 2 years' time. It's just not fair. It's also true that I think on the left side of the spectrum, we're used to nonprofit philanthropy, and this is about investing for a profit. We'll get there. We're just not getting there yet.
Back with more with Laura Flanders. Again, her book, Blue Grit, True Democrats. I'm having a hard time saying that. True Democrats take back politics from the politicians. We welcome your calls as well. We'll open our phone lines now. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest, Laura Flanders, her book, Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. She's also, of course, the host of Radio Nation, heard on Air America, formerly hosted a program locally here in the San Francisco Bay Area on KALW. There were a lot of significant things, obviously, that happened this week, the massacre at Virginia Tech and also the Supreme Court decision. I'm interested in how you apply what you write about in your book to those powerful moments. On Virginia Tech, it's been interesting that in the wake, and perhaps it's just because it's so horrific and people are focusing so much as they ought on the grief of the families, but there hasn't been a lot of talk coming out of that, at least so far, on bringing back gun control as an important topic of discussion in this country. Some, but haven't heard lots about it. Senator Feinstein in this state has talked about it some. But how do you apply that?
Well, I think DiFi was the only person who said anything, and it was shameful. I mean, I think that this has been an issue that Democrats are terrified of touching because they know that in many of these red states and so-called, and in particular the western Rocky states, that they're really looking towards to make gains in 08.
And have
made gains already. They are clear that gun control per se is anathema, and that the Democratic candidates for president are routinely tagged as those who would take your guns away. Now, I found in Nevada, I went to Las Vegas, it was the week that Dick Cheney shot his friend, and I thought, okay, well, I'm going to have to be talking about this weekend. Let me go to a gun range and talk to somebody there to try to understand how they think. So I walked into the first gun range I saw that said it advertised you could fire an Uzi, that you could shoot an automatic weapon, fire an Uzi. And I thought, okay, well, here you have it. I thought it would be safe. I wouldn't be found in a ditch the next day because there was a Volkswagen Bug parked outside. And I thought, yeah, there's hippies in there. So I went in and I introduced myself. I said, okay, I'm a lefty talk show host from New York. Talk to me about gun control. Talk to me about gun rights. Talk to me. They were thrilled. They said no one has ever come in and asked them a question. The people that worked there were former Dallas police chiefs or cops, trainers. And they said, after we had a long, we talked a lot and they had me fire an Uzi, and that's a whole other story. They said, you know, nobody wants enforced gun control more than we do. Nobody wants more punishment of those who leave guns around to be used by minors or people without a license more than we do. Nobody cares more that the gun laws that we have are enforced more than we do. And if I had been a Democrat coming out of this week, I would be saying, okay, well, we've had a lot. We've learned a lot about the limits on school psychotherapists about what they can do when somebody has a record of instability but hasn't actually broken any laws. What can we find out about the way that record does or doesn't get entered into the database that gun shop owners use? Because what we know from Virginia Tech is that the gun shop owner says he followed the law before he sold this young, very disturbed man two pistols. And does that mean that school records aren't entered into the federal database? If you have an harassment order against you, that isn't used against, that doesn't show up when you are buying a gun. It's the kind of approach that I think could find Democrats friends. And sure, I mean, ultimately, I'd like to improve the gun control laws. But in the meantime, I think we could be seen as allies for those who want to uphold the laws that do exist. And maybe we could make some friends along the way.
And does that come back to what we talked about earlier about both sort of fear of candor, I suppose, but also just not being willing to tap into something that's authentic and express it in that sort of from the heart way.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I know that it's hard to run for president. I've never done it. And I can only imagine the pressures on you to say the right thing and not to put a step out of place. But I do think that the reason that a candidate like Barack Obama is on fire right now is because he's speaking to people's hearts. Now, we may not know what he stands for, but we are moved by the promise he makes and the belief he expresses in a place that is essentially a progressive definition of America, going from a less expansive definition of human rights and civil rights and constitutional rights to a more expansive one, a more inclusive place. He's moving people in a way that I think they've wanted to be moved, and the only people speaking to their hearts have been Republicans.
And let's go to our calls. We welcome our participation in our program this morning. Again, the number 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us too at forum@kqed.org. Carol is up first in San Rafael. Carol, you're on.
Good morning. I am co-chair of a grassroots organization, a really strong one here in Marin called Democracy for America. And one of the things that we have been shocked to find out is that the Democratic Party hierarchy is as intransigent and as dug in to the status quo as the Republicans, and they are very reluctant to acknowledge grassroots. Or they can't. In other words, they keep hoping we'll go away. What are your suggestions? What do you think, other than keep beating at the door, which is what we're doing?
Well, Carol, I think you're doing the right thing. I'd be curious to know what your actual experience was of trying to get the establishment to shift. I think it's extraordinary that Democracy for America, which grew out of the Howard Dean primary campaign, continues to hang tough all across the country. That was a network that got built and remained, and it's exciting. I think eventually we're going to see primary challenges when candidates like those supported by Carol go up against those establishment candidates and win. We saw it in 06 in a few cases. As I said, Carol Shea Porter in New Hampshire was one. There were others besides. John Tester wasn't the establishment's candidate in Montana. They supported the other guy who they thought would raise more money. The one big defeat on the Democrats' side this last November was in Illinois' 6th district, where the candidate that Rahm Emanuel and, to be fair, Barack Obama supported, Tammy Duckworth, a double amputee from the Iraq War, lost against a grassrootser, Christine Sigalis, who had a lot of support there in the community that lives near the Chicago airport. And a lot of people believe she would have won if only the establishment hadn't undermined her campaign and poured millions of dollars into Duckworth instead. So, I don't know, I believe that perhaps pragmatics will win out. And if it doesn't, well, people like Carol will have acquired the skills and savvy to take someplace else.
Carol, thanks for the call. Dave in Berkeley writes, enjoying the program, could you ask your guest about her views on the notion of Democrats potentially embracing much more strongly our secular history and rejecting more strongly any hints of theocratic notions in Washington? You write about this some in your book, too, about there was a lot of talk coming out of 2004 that Democrats need to get more comfortable in talking about religion in particular. And it does seem, again, this is this authenticity question, it seems to me, that if you have someone like Tim Kaine, the governor of Virginia, who comes from a religious tradition, you can do that, but it's not anything you can really speak to unless you if that doesn't come from the heart as well.
You know, it's been kind of nauseating to watch Hillary Clinton quoting endlessly from the Bible, which she's done since about November 3rd of 2004. I think one of the bedrock principles of our country's constitution is secularism. And I don't think there's any alternative for an elected official but to say they will uphold secularism in this country. That said, I believe as long as you're protecting your right to be free of religion, then you're ipso facto protecting the right of everyone to practice their religion freely. But I do think that this sort of knee-jerk reaction to the 04 results, which I think were kind of misinterpreted about that so-called moral vote, that there's been this idea that Democrats need to embrace the Bible, and from half of them, it just sounds ridiculous. And I think that there is a broad agreement in this country amongst those who vote for Democrats, who are even in the center of the electoral arena, the political arena, that first we have to defend secularism from its critics, of which there are many, and then we can talk about everything else. But to push the Bible, I think, is getting into very difficult territory. Makes me very suspicious, and I don't think that's the way to go, unless, as you said, it really is you speaking from the heart. And even then, I want you, if you're a politician, to tell me you're going to go by the rule of law of man and woman, and not the rule of God when you get into government.
I want to ask you about the war on terror. You don't address it in your book, and it seems to me that in some ways liberals need to contend with that. Peter Beinart, in his book, The Good Fight, writes about how liberals sometimes too often tend to think of only the right as their enemy, that the biggest worry in the world isn't terrorism, it's George W. Bush. And his argument is that Democrats need to think that this is their war, too. They need to engage. They need to push back. They need to have a strategy, because the war, the terrorism is a real force that must be obviously contended with.
Well, I don't focus on it a lot in the book, because I was really looking at grassroots groups, and I found that although there are some interesting initiatives statewide, I mean across the country, where cities have signed up to oppose the Patriot Act, I didn't find that the war on terror was propelling people into office, as it were, or to run for office. Although people like John Tester made a very strong stand saying they would repeal the Patriot Act if they ever got a chance. I grew up in the UK. My father was British, and I went to school in the 1970s at a period where IRA terrorism was rampant, and it was certainly something we were trained to fear. The answer, I watched the British government go through various phases. One was, you know, flood Northern Ireland with troops. That didn't work. One was suspend basically all rule of law and round people up and try to bring prosecutions. It was called internment. They barely brought any of those prosecutions that stuck. And what they did was radicalize a whole generation of people who got wrapped up in these, got swept up in these internments, and found themselves spending years in jail for no good reason. I think that's the route that this administration's been taking, and it won't work. What we know is that what works to combat terrorism is good policing, is cooperation among security forces internationally, is addressing the grievances at the root of those terrorist complaints, if you will. And I know this is now cost in this country as great submission to the enemy, but frankly, even Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of Britain, during the hunger strike years, she was finally brought to concede that there was an employment discrimination problem in Northern Ireland. There was housing inequality. There was political inequality. And what changed and marginalized those who were embracing violence in Northern Ireland was the raising of the economic conditions of life for most people there in the north. Now, without getting into tremendous details, eventually, a political settlement was brought to Northern Ireland, and we're seeing now even the heads of the most radical Republican nationalist groups and the heads of the loyalist groups meet together in a new provisional government. This is a political solution. I believe the challenge of terrorism today will have the same, and the sooner we get down to business working with our allies internationally, not against them and withholding evidence, the better. But I don't think that's, again, a left-right approach. There are a lot of people working in law enforcement on the right of the political spectrum who would agree.
Laura Flanders, our guest, her book again, Blue Grit. And back to our calls. John in San Rafael. John, you're on.
Hi. The book Fooled Again, I don't remember the author's name, basically asserted that we had two straight coup d'etats. You know, the Republicans succeeded in suppressing Democratic votes in districts traditionally Democratic, and then also that there was an awful lot of electronic voter fraud, you know, hacking computer voting. And I agree. I think there was two straight coup d'etats. I think the Cheney Bush administration is illegitimate. There was plenty of things to have convinced the voters that in 2004 that Kerry, while imperfect, would have been a lot better than Bush. And I'm just dumbfounded, and I just don't really see how all this grassroots activity can do any good unless we have honest elections.
John, thank you.
Well, thank you, John. I think Fooled Again was written by Mark Crispin Miller, I think. you know, in fact, to the contrary of what John says, exactly the kind of grassroots activism I'm talking about has made the difference on this issue of voting integrity, which is the question of do the machines work right? Also on the question of voting rights, which is are certain people being denied their right to vote. The first people to raise the alarm in Ohio, in Columbus, were the young people of a group called the League of Pissed Off Voters, who were the people on the ground from Ohio who could see that there was a problem early on. And I was alerted to them because they called my radio show that night. They lived in the communities and they knew that whereas long lines at voting booths was by outsiders seen as a great thing, it means you got big turnout, by insiders, as it were, meaning people who lived in that community, they could see this was the line that wasn't moving. This was a line that wasn't there during primary season when usually, you know, you've got, when it turned out they had as many machines in the voting booths, as many machines in the voting precincts as they had in the general election. Local people could see that there was a problem they could recognize. They signaled the alarm. They held the first hearings that brought testimony to the public eye that John Conyers based his report on. Now those grassroots people, again, elected a new Secretary of State in Columbus that is prosecuting the Board of Elections of one county, Cuyahoga County, where there were definitely shenanigans with the machines and the placement of machines. It's been grassroots as who've brought this issue to the boil. I think we've got a challenge ahead of us, but this is a victory story for Blue Grit.
A number of people want to ask about Air America and its challenges. One person writes...
I'm just
reading the email here. I would suggest that one reason for Air America's lack of success is that many, if not most, liberals don't need to hear themselves think. Rhetoric is always rhetoric. I don't mind listening to opposition positions stated intelligently, not as sound bites and not as rhetoric. I think as a progressive, and perhaps speaking for more progressives, we feel the conservative ideology is a niche market, one that unfortunately has taken over the country like a delusional fantasy. I don't think liberal values should be pushed into a corner and labeled Air America. And Bob, who joins us this morning on the Sirius Satellite Network, I suspect in Portland, Maine, wants to make a comment about Air America, too. Bob, you're on.
I'm going to back up a little bit on my original comment because I tried to get a radio show, a progressive radio show, off the ground in New Jersey for several years, five, six, 7 years. Went out, raised my own money, took the recordings down to the Democratic State Committee, and got absolutely no help whatsoever. I offered to turn the show over to people selected by the Democratic State Committee. They just weren't interested. And they were certainly absolutely unwilling to put any money into it. And your point about Limbaugh being back for millions of dollars long before he became popular is absolutely accurate. Adolf Coors spent literally millions of dollars through some of the Southern California Republican politicians to get Limbaugh off the ground and get him into a national market.
Bob, thank you. Yeah, thanks for the observation. I also want to ask, Laura Flanders, whether or not it's good to have well-funded media to the far right, well-funded media to the left, and to not have, as Sandy Close, you were quoting before, the sort of gathering around media that we share.
Hmm. Well, I mean, ideally, we want all of the above. I mean, there's no question that there's no reason that the radical right should control the airwaves and control the debate. And there's also no debating that they've had an impact. How was it the welfare queen became such a stereotype? It was pushed by Rush Limbaugh day in, day out, and that led us to welfare reform because people had so vilified poor women. With all of these questions, you've seen a real impact, and I would say, as they put it so politely, a coarsening of the debate with the impact of the radical right on the radio. On the other hand, so do you want to just create that? No, but I don't think people would say Air America is just the mirror image of Rush Limbaugh. At least I would hope you wouldn't think that. The idea that the one niche market just took over like a virus, as one writer put it, it wasn't the weather. It wasn't a shift in sunspot patterns. It was investment by the right. I think we need all of the above. I think we need the radio that will be there to present a counterpoint to the Rush Limbaughs and the Michael Savages. I also think we need a meeting place. And I think programs like this one, the program that I used to do and that continues at KALW, Your Call, provides that kind of a meeting place. What we need to do, each one of us, is to support the media that we rely on. Have you paid your pledge? And if you're an investor or a small business owner, why not put your money where your mouth is and advertise on media you like?
And we welcome your calls, pledge calls or not, at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us your thoughts, too, at forum@kqed.org. Ricardo is on next in San Francisco. Ricardo, you're on.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Jay Iverson, and hello, Laura Flanders. You may remember me from your call radio.
I do. Familiar voice.
I mentioned something on off-air to the fellow about the screener about the crow, the biggest crow America would ever swallow, which I mentioned right at the beginning of this travesty of a war we have right now. And I think we're still moving in that direction toward what our greatest specter in this whole life pattern as human beings is that's being missed beyond global warming, which is nuclear war and the conventional wars that lead to it eventually, just as I said about this crow. Now, I wanted to bring something up, if I could, about irrational beings at the head of government, such as in the White House, and what has brought us an aircraft carrier with a president dressed as an air flyer saying we had victory in Iraq. And so we produced Valerie Plame, Louis Libby, the Blair Memo, people meeting in the Azores saying we're going to destroy a particular country. And then we have a John McCain running for president who says Barbara Ann, as the Beach Boys say it, but bomb Iran is a joke. And then we look toward authenticity with Barack Obama, looking for authentic versions of truth, but we don't know what he stands for yet, and Hillary Clinton wants to bomb Iran also.
Ricardo, I'm going to hold you there. Thanks for your calls and your observations, and since he's a familiar caller to you, Laura, I'm going to ask for your response.
Well, I just want to say one thing about media before we move on to what Ricardo had to say. One of the points I make in the book is that as a longtime media critic, I've always often complained about the lack of progressive media and the huge megaphone that you have on the right. On the same time, I spent weeks on the radio, months on the radio in the run-up to the last election with callers calling in to Air America saying, how do I get a yard sign for Kerry Edwards? And I was like, I don't even have a yard, let alone a sign. Why are you asking me? What's wrong with your local Democratic Party? And gradually I found out, well, there was no local Democratic Party. The website, I was directing people to John Kerry's website. Finally, somebody, maybe it was Ricardo, called and said, you can't get yard signs at the John Kerry website. And it made me think again, you know, about the complaining that you hear on the Democratic side about we don't have a megaphone. If you can't get your voters, people working for you, the very basic kind of tool of tin pot communication in most parts of this country, the yard sign, you've really got something to answer for. And on Ricardo, Ricardo's question about how big a lie are we willing to accept, I think most of this country didn't believe the lie and certainly hasn't believed the lie on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq since about a week after U.S. troops landed there. The problem is it's been very hard to find leadership to call this administration out. This week, as I understand it, Harry Reid finally, and I've got many complaints with Harry Reid, but Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, finally apparently told George W. Bush this war is lost. That kind of plain talking, we want to see it followed by action, but that kind of plain talking is only coming about because of blue grit Democratic pressure telling the truth and demanding movement from its leaders.
Lisa writes, I just want to say that I agree with what Ms. Flanders is saying, and I've been looking for a place to hear the other points of view, which sometimes without getting offended due to the sensational approaches that they might take on right-wing shows. And so after listening to this interview, I'll make an effort to listen to Air America. Doug writes, I'll tell you why I don't listen to Air America. I live on the peninsula, and I don't want to have to drive to San Francisco to listen, and making the comment, obviously, that your listenership is limited to the stations that carry it, and it's not always available.
Well, you can get it on Sirius, or rather XM satellite, and you can get my show anyway, podcast, starting next week at the website of The Quake. So I encourage you to take one of those two options, and maybe there's a local station out there you can encourage to take one or other of the Air America broadcasts. You don't have to take the whole feed. You can take one or other that you prefer and see if we could find ourselves a place on more parts of the dial.
Francis in Healdsburg, go ahead.
Hi. Well, I've been listening to this program, and I completely agree that those who are in Washington are not representing my concerns, and I believed our system of government was supposed to be representative. But I still am not clear how we actually break through that system that is so entrenched in Washington that they have to play the political game in order to accomplish anything. And unfortunately, we look toward those people to enact bills and legislation to help us address some of our concerns. What are actual tools that we can use to break through?
You need to buy the book, Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. It's almost a how-to, or at least it shows how some people are figuring out how to do what you're saying. Key issues, minimum wages. This wasn't an issue brought to us from Washington down. This was an issue built from the grassroots up. You saw as late as 2004, two states, as I said, Florida and Miami, passing these ballot initiatives to increase the minimum wage by a dollar. Those initiatives passed in every part of those two states, rich, poor, rural, urban, conservative, liberal, by a 2-to-1 majority. We're talking Nevada's rurals voted 2-to-1 for a raise in the minimum wage. Why John Kerry was unable to secure all those voters, and half of the people voted for that and also for George Bush, well, I think that has to do with how poorly Kerry's campaign tied themselves to the issue. When I spoke to some of the organizers, they said it was like pulling teeth to get him to mention it. He was talking about something else. He didn't realize what was hot in Nevada. But this sort of initiative on the ground is the way that the right has moved forward on stuff I would object to, ballot initiatives about gay marriage and reproductive rights, you name it. But on the progressive side, it's working as well to raise heat around an issue, to show legislators that it can be a popular one, to push those legislators to do the right thing, move from minimum wages to living wages. I believe the positive work can start from the bottom up. Our media give us politics from the top down, but that doesn't mean we have to do it that way.
And in the end, though, you still believe in the possibilities, and the possibilities in particular of the Democratic Party. You're not advocating to go out and start a third or fourth party.
Well, you know, I did tell you that my listeners call me an optaholic. You know, I am less interested in which party label rises to the top in this country behind policies that make life better for the people who live here, and more interested in regular folks getting engaged in the process. I wrote this book in part to introduce two populations to each other. Those that I'm familiar with listening to Air America, whose lives, it seems, sort of hung in the balance with the Kerry Edwards campaign. And so many people called me on election night saying they were going to move to Canada that finally a Canadian from Vancouver called to say, you do know you need a visa to come here. Those folks whose whole idea of politics is electoral politics and mostly presidential politics, and the people that I knew from community radio here and elsewhere who had so lost faith in their electoral system that they were almost exclusively engaged in movement politics, men, women politics, environmental, green politics, and barely participated in elections at all. I think what we're seeing is people who were in the second category moving into the first, learning skills and savvy, and if they decide eventually they're not going to see movement in the Democrats and take that someplace else, that's fine. We'll be better off for it.
Laura Flanders, our guest this hour again. Her new book, Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Thanks for being on our program.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Dave.
Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer this hour, Dave Freeman. And the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.